Hey, what's up, everybody, and welcome back to Uncanny, the unofficial X-Men 97 podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Condon, and today we're going to go into our episode 3 of the re-release of the series entitled Fire Made Flesh. And I think it goes without saying that anyone who has ever read an X-Men comic knows who that's referencing. And that is Phoenix, the cosmic entity that possessed Jean Grey and others into doing horrible, amazing, but horrible, generally, things. And so we actually see in the opening title sequence for this episode some scenes that I think inform really what's going to be going on and what are some major plot developments within this episode itself, which is very, very, very dense. I have to say this is probably the densest episode in the series so far, even in the whole of the property of the X-Men animation. There was a lot going on in this episode. I may almost say too much, but we're going to get into that in a little bit. So as I was saying, Fire Made Flesh. In the opening credit sequence, we not only see characters introduced, but we see some cutscenes that are pretty interesting because they reference things that were very important in X-Men history, like Jean becoming the Dark Phoenix. Right? This, you know, we see a scene, we see an animation in the intro title of Jean as the Phoenix going Dark Phoenix and basically, you know, going nuts and almost nuking her boyfriend at the time. The one interesting tidbit is we see Roberto being kind of caged in by a mob of angry anti-mutant zealots who, in the 1990s series, that character, the animation in the intro, wasn't Roberto. It was Jubilee. Which is, again, very interesting. So that's new. We see Princess Lilandra from the Shi'ar getting angry and stomping on a control panel in a Shi'ar, I'm assuming a Shi'ar vessel. You know, these are all Easter eggs. You know, like, they're just, like, laying Easter eggs, like the Easter bunny, not to mention Easter's this weekend. Hope, you know, if you're celebrating, happy Easter. And, you know, all of this is going on to basically set up what would be the densest, right, the most exhibitionist episode in the series thus far, and I think in the entire season, you know, to include previous episodes that were done in the 90s. There's a lot going on in this episode. You know, we are introduced to a couple of huge plot developments. Right, so, you know, I have to spoil stuff if I'm going to talk about this episode. There's no way to not spoil the episode because it's so dense and it's so full of Easter eggs and plot points. So that being said, if you do not want to hear spoilers, please stop listening right now. I'm going to give you to the count of three. One, two, three. Okay, cool. You've seen the episode. Great. Well, let's break it down. Again, not shot for shot, but I will be talking about some of what we see. So it is revealed that the woman who fathered Scott's baby is not Jean. I saw this coming. I think anyone who's read the comic saw this coming. It's Madeline Pryor. It is the clone that Mr. Sinister created to essentially play God and have Scott and Jean have a baby that he could manipulate. You know, that is from the comics. I was surprised that they kind of introduced Madeline Pryor in this way, which seemed very rushed, right? You know, and I know they're selling the Hasbro 97 Goblin Queen figurettes, and it's very fun and sexy and cool, and people can dress up like her at Comic-Con and be like, hey, wow, I love your boobs. And, oh, yeah, you're Goblin Queen. Cool. Yeah, I get it. It's a little fan service-y, but man, do they teleport from from this being Jean to this being Madeline Pryor so quickly. Like, you know, it just seems almost hard to believe that someone who, I guess, was living with the X-Men for months, if not definitely over 9 months, would suddenly just flip out and turn herself into some kind of demonic entity, even though Sinister was behind it. You know, but here are some major qualms I'm starting to have with what I'm seeing in the writing. And I hate to say it, but it's kind of lazy, and it is falling outside of continuity. Right? Jean and Scott, in this show, have a very steep history with Mr. Sinister. They know who Nathaniel Essex is. Scott has fought Nathaniel Essex on numerous occasions. He knows who that is. Beast obviously knows who that is because he name drops. Oh, snap. She's a clone made by Mr. Sinister. You know, but Scott knows who that is. Everybody knows who that is. Morph definitely knows who that is, which is revealed later. But, you know, Jean, if Jean has all the memories, so if Madeline, let's say, has all the memories of Jean Grey, Jean would be very aware of whose voice that is on the intercom. You know, she wouldn't react as a surprise, "Who are you?" No, she'd be like, "Sinister." Like, she knows who that is. Right? She would be more disgusted than shocked. Like, she would be like, "Oh no, not him." Like, Sinister was, like, overused in the original 90s animation. I'm just going to say it. He was, you know, quintessential bad guy. You know, scary voice, very, very contrastial. You know, he had like white, like death white skin, black hair, goatee. Because, you know, people with a goatee are evil, right? Says a guy who wears a goatee and mustache. You get it, you know? I go, okay, Bishop's not evil. He's cool. But, you know, anyone else with a goatee, dangerous. Mr. Sinister, oh boy. He's like the Snidely Whiplash of X-Men. You know, so we get it, you know? And though I understand Scott, per se, of kind of rejecting and kind of having doubts, but, I mean, Scott's reaction is also a little hard to believe because he teleports in his emotional status from, "I've had sexual relations with this woman, we fathered a child together, and now I'm just, like, standoffish with her." That is very hard to believe. I mean, hell, I was married and divorced. I would still not react the way Scott did to this woman. I mean, I never had a kid, but I mean, you just had a kid with this person. Who cares if it's a clone? There's still a human being. You know, a clone is essentially just a biological entity grown from someone else's genetic code. They're still a person. They have their own thoughts and opinions and feelings. You know, I mean, I think this is a little bit more complicated because Madeline had her memory implanted from another person. You know, so she's basically a duplicate, which is kind of creepy. And yeah, I understand that, you know, Sinister gets into her mind and reactivates her mind control. And then, you know, our clone Jean, or Jean Doe, as Morph calls her, freaks out, turns into the Goblin Queen by taking different elements from the room and then, like, turning it into clothing. I don't know. That was a little cringy for me, that she's just, like, pulling the clothing from the box and, you know, the teddy bear and, like, the, you know, the curtain, and making this very, very revealing outfit not necessary. Why would she do that? Or is Sinister complete in control and she's just basically a puppet? You know, then wouldn't she just be like, "I'm Sinister"? I don't know. There's a lot of this that seems like, kind of like, remember those X-Files episodes that were like the Creature of the Week episode, where it wasn't really about, you know, story canon, but just kind of like, oh, this is a scary thing that happens and we have to wrap up this entire plot line in one episode. That's what this felt like. It felt like an entire plot line just jet-packed through so that we could say, we did it. We did the Madeline Pryor arc in one episode. Yay, us. Like, it was a lot. It was very, very quickly paced. And, you know, and they got some stuff in. You know, they got stuff in about Morph, right? A little bit. Being a member of the queer community, I'm only to assume, based on his reaction and his feelings of exclusion, where everyone else is partnered up and he's kind of like, well, what about me? Who do I pine for? You know, he might even think Logan is hot, but Logan is not bisexual. Logan is definitely straight, you know, and, you know, Morph is kind of like left in his own fantasy realm in his head because he has to basically entertain himself and his own sexuality in isolation, which, you know, back in the 90s, the queer community was definitely not as accepted socially as the queer community is now. That's just true. You know, not to mention coming out as gay, you know, come out as bisexual, you know, you were seen as a pariah socially in the 90s, you know? And so having a character who is openly gay in the mid 90s where the show takes place, it would be harder for that person to come out. So I'm hoping they delve into that with Morph, right? Because these, you know, psychic manifestations, they kind of play on, you know, internal conflicts of the characters. And I think they do a good job with that. You know, I think, you know, there's a lot of cringy creepiness that's going on in this sequence here where Madeline Pryor kind of takes over and is basically psychically tormenting all these characters. You know, everything they see and experience is all in their heads. You know, it kind of reminds me of when Xavier in the 90s story went kind of bonkers and was taken over by something else. You know, a psychic mutant can really wreak havoc on other people. So I'm glad we see that. But again, I just felt the story and the pacing was so rushed. I did make a note. I did love Beast's response to seeing the almost Miyazaki-like character in the elevator saying, oh, well, I believe I got on the wrong floor. I mean, that's funny. You know, that's I think one of us has the wrong floor. Very funny. I did like that. You know, but, you know, we've kind of, I get it. It's very, you know, Saturday morning cartoons. But again, that's what we're doing here. You know, this is a cartoon. This is an evocative cartoon from the 90s. It's kind of being self-referential with this kind of grandiose animation and very soap opera-like exposition. You know, it is being honest, right? So halfway through the episode, I'm like, well, this is just jetpacking. But then I'm like, well, is it? Because it's kind of following a formula that was very prevalent in the 90s, which was you have a story arc that has to start and end in a single episode. I mean, look at the Goosebumps series. Look at any series that was put out for kids. All these story arcs, you had to introduce characters, come up with a climactic arc, and then a conclusion, all within like an hour. That's tough, right? You know, we have the luxury now of these streaming platforms where you can have, you know, 6-7 episodes in a miniseries. But way back when, you know, we kind of relied on television, you had to kind of show as much as you could within the confines of a single episode. So, you know, I think there is a reason they're doing this in this way. Now, will the general public look at this as I am and kind of be forgiving about the jetpacking? I don't know. But, you know, I think it's important to be cognizant of what this show is trying to embody. Anywho, one thing I did love is when the OG Jean kind of wakes up from her, like, semi-coma and just basically just takes over and just like, I'm just going to fix all this because I'm Jean and I can do anything. I mean, you know, Jean is very much like a apex omega level mutant, right? She, you know, she was the Phoenix for a time, you know, and having her and this Madeline Pryor kind of duke it out, so to speak, in this kind of emotional psychic rapport, it's fun to watch. But again, I don't understand how Maddie could have been warped so quickly. You know, maybe over the course of several episodes, it would make more sense, but I digress. So I also found it was kind of cool that Magneto and Rogue, after coming in and seeing everyone just kind of like recouping, you know, from obviously they were, you know, this post-coitus, like, what is going on here? What did we miss when we were off exercise? You know, and everyone's like half dead. And Magneto's like, Sinister, it's time to end him for good. I'm like, yes. You know, because I always wanted to be like, what did Magneto think about Mr. Sinister? I mean, he's obviously had to interact with him in the past. Like, you know, because Mr. Sinister's kind of a scum. Like, there's no moral kind of justification. He's just a bad person. And Magneto, you could kind of look at him and say, well, you do bad things, but in your mind, you think they're justified and you have some moral compass. Sinister has no moral compass. He's the most boring villain in the entire Marvel universe. He's just evil. Like, you know, just evil. Why don't you just call him Mr. Evil? You know what I mean? I don't know. I always felt that Mr. Sinister was kind of a cop-out. You know, he doesn't really have any depth. He's just, I'm a bad guy. Whatever. I do think it's interesting, though, that they're really changing Nathan Summers' backstory in this. So since I've already said spoilers, Nathan Summers, Nathan Christopher Summers, in this show, I guess he's Nathan Charles Summers, is a Cable. I said that in my last episode. And unlike in the comics, where there's like this huge story arc that spans tons of different issues, they jetpack to have Sinister introducing the techno-organic virus to Nathan to make him invulnerable? Okay. Because that, I guess that makes sense, but someone with a techno-organic virus wouldn't be invulnerable. They would just be a part of the technarchy, which is this whole other thing, you know, connecting to an alien race called the Phalanx or something. And another character from the X-Men lore, Warlock, was a part of this kind of hive mind, techno-organic society. But it just doesn't make sense in the show. And I think everyone's going to be confused and they're going to be like, techno-organic virus? What? Why? I mean, why is that okay? I guess we're going to believe that Sinister found a way to, I don't know, interact with this alien race and save some of their stuff. I don't know. Whatever. Sure, Marvel. Yeah, I guess Nathan Summers was, you know, stricken with the techno-organic virus by Sinister because of an experiment. All right, yes, cut the check, moving on. I do like a couple other things here. I noted I loved seeing Morph turn into some characters that always I felt needed more screen time, like Magic or Ilyana Rasputin, Pyotr Rasputin, or Colossus's younger sister. She was one of the first members of the New Mutants. So I really actually hope we see Ilyana in the show, other than just Morph turning into her so that we can have another Easter egg. Though we love Easter eggs at Marvel Studios. Not to be snippy. But, you know, whatever. The fight with Madeline Pryor and Magneto, again, very cool. you know, very reflective of the comics where Jean was fighting Magneto. And Jean's like, oh, you can move metal around, cute. I can move everything. At like, very, you know, it's tongue-in-cheek. It's impressive. But again, as I said earlier in my feedback, this episode really seemed to be more about exposition, right? For people not familiar with the property than actually about creating a cohesive, believable story. Right? The narrative in this episode was so rushed that I'm just like, I hope this doesn't derail people from wanting to watch it continually. You know, I understand you're trying to wrap up a lot of loose ends, you know, from the earlier series to now. But, you know, Jean wasn't pregnant in the early series. We didn't have a Madeline Pryor. This could have been a part of a longer arc to have us believe Maddie's transition into this demonic entity. But he just kind of said, well, we got to do this, so make it happen. So, you know, this is what happens when writers are kind of put into a corner and they're said, do it. Do it now. Do it fast. I'm just assuming. You know, but again, as I said earlier on, this is also kind of how a lot of Saturday morning cartoons were done in the 90s. I'm not saying it was good to wrap an entire story arc in a single episode where you're introducing new characters and just like explaining away why they're going to be leaving and what happened to them emotionally. You know, it's a lot of yada yadaing that I think doesn't do a service to the property. It just my opinion, very, very, very like a soap opera, you know, or like a telenovela where you're just, you know, you're the father of my uncle's sister, who's also my neighbor, who potted my plants and now is the principal at the high school. Ba-da! Like, I get it. You know, there's an audience for that. I just don't know if it's this show. Anywho, yeah, just a lot of dizzying stuff. You know, we do see kind of Jean's history here for those who needed to be reminded of it. How Jean got her powers awakened because she saved or tried to save one of her, you know, childhood friends in her neighborhood from dying. It doesn't really go into that. I mean, it shows her running to try and save this young girl who's chasing a basketball into the street. But what you don't see is the kid gets hit by the car and is dying. And Jean runs up to her friend and literally halts her soul from leaving to the afterlife. I mean, that's explored in the comics. That's what happens with Jean. Jean goes into a coma because of the effort. And Professor Xavier has to visit her in the hospital to get her out of the coma and ask why she's waiting for her friend. Like, literally, Jean psychically left her body and was waiting in purgatory after her friend left for the afterlife and was, like, able to sustain her astral form in perpetuity, which scared the crap out of Xavier because, like, that's a lot of power. Anyway, that's a very deep cut. But they try and do that, and they show Charles going to Jean's house and talking to Jean's parents, and, you know, they kind of yada yada over the whole Phoenix saga, which is hard to yada yada over. But, you know, I guess you have to do it if you're going to try and just get people caught up who don't know the property. But it's a lot of yada yada. I mean, again, so much yada yada, I'm almost yada yada'd to boredom because it's so much. I mean, you know, if I was teaching a screenwriting class, I would probably say this is probably not a good example of how to write an episode for streaming or television in present day because it's too much. It's just too much. There's too much going on. And people will not be able to wrap their heads around it in totality. Right, they'll get bits and pieces, you know, there'll be bits and pieces from this that they'll like, but, like, you know, you just this montage of various touch points in Gene's history all kind of mushed and squished into this very, very quick succession, and Madeline having a baby, and, you know, Gene and Maddie being, you know, in the womb with the child. Like, it's a lot, you know, and again, I understand it. You're trying to, you know, expedite Jean coming back to the X-Men, but also being fractured because she was experimented on by Sinister, which, you know, we see in the episode hinted at numerous times. And she says that her memory was lost, that she doesn't have memory. But then I guess with this interaction with Maddie, she borrows Maddie's rememberings of the past. I don't know. There's just a lot. And then, you know, when she does her, you know, psychic voodoo on Maddie, Maddie snaps out of it, you know. So I guess, you know, and then I did not like the way that Sinister was animated in this. I mean, I thought it was very lazy. I mean, all the characters look very well defined, but Sinister just kind of looks just crappy. Like, Sinister looks like how a villain would be animated in, like, the early 90s. Like, very, very sloppy. Like, just hardly any details other than contours. Very, like a weird version of Morbius from Spider-Man. It just didn't look good. Which is sad, because if you look at Scott and Maddie and even Nathan, they look great. But Sinister looked like crap. So hopefully they don't make him look like this in future episodes that involve Sinister. I just didn't think they spent a lot of time on that character, you know, from an animation point of view. It just looks like he belongs in another property. Like, he is a character they just cut and pasted from the 90s. Not to be nitpicky, but, you know, we should be, as artists, be a little nitpicky, because this is a property that many of us care about and love, like me. And again, Nathan, you know, succumbing to the T-virus, or T-O-virus, like this, it's just so forced. I don't know. And then Bishop just conveniently being there in, you know, their time period, and being like, well, I got a time band. Let's take the kid back to my time. I know a guy. Like, how convenient. Like, I don't know. I really hope the rest of the episodes aren't like this. Like, it's almost rushed. It's like, look, there's X-Men on the screen and they're doing things. Wow, X-Men on the screen doing things. How exciting. Buy the property. Buy the action figures. I mean, I hope that's not what's going to happen, because the original 90s series, stemming perhaps the last season, they were really well thought out. And some of the story arcs took place over 3 episodes. Like, the Dark Phoenix saga was 3 episodes, right? And this Madeline Pryor story arc was kind of really just 1 or maybe 2 episodes. Like, you know, it's just kind of, that's a real quick turnaround, you know? And so, you know, they decide, you know, to send Nathan into the future with Bishop, and Bishop's, I know a guy, is Forge. I mean, from the original series, we know Bishop and Forge had a very intimate interaction and connection, like a father-son kind of relationship, and Forge helped Bishop with his technology and even devised the time band, which he uses on his wrist, which is, I think it was an interesting Easter egg to have Storm meeting up with a younger version of Forge in Texas at some bar where, you know, where she's just chilling. I'm assuming because the writers thought it'd be tongue-in-cheek for someone to walk in to a place called the Mockingbird, and Storm's sitting there in her awesome, again, I do like that they designed Storm in this scene to have her, like, epic costume that she kind of created for herself when she lost her powers back in the 80s. And then, you know, we see Forge as a young man saying, wouldn't it be nice if someone could just make it rain? Like, We know that. The other scene I did like in this, and I say, you know, it was okay. I'm not happy with this episode, is Scott and Jean kind of in their bedroom that's like busted up, and Scott's on one side, Jean's on the other, and, you know, they're probably thinking, you know, in their brains, oh my God, you just like slept with a stranger that you thought was me. Anywho, a lot going on, but I care about the property and I want to talk about it. So until next time, or until next episode, keep it classic.